Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an appraisal of outgoing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's testimony before the Senate and House committees, where she faced hostile questions from Republicans who have long tried to blow up the tragic incident in Benghazi into a major foreign policy issue. A former deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence, who was an intelligence analyst on Libya, Wayne White, joins us for a reality check. Then we go to Israel for an update on the surprising election results where a little-known new party, Yesh Atid, There Is a Future, came in second. A former speaker of the Knesset, Avraham Berg, joins us to discuss what kind of government coalition Prime Minister Netanyahu will be able to form with this new staunchly secular party, who are unlikely to join a coalition with the right-wing ultra-Orthodox parties who make up the current Likud government. Then finally, we'll look into the new report released today by the Bureau of Labor Statistics showing that union membership in America has dropped to a record low, with a one-year drop in 2012 of union representation in the private sector from 6.9% to 6.6%. John Schmidt, a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., who is co-author with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein of three editions of The State of Working America, joins us. And joining us now is Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern and North African countries. He was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group and previously served as deputy director of the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Researcher's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups, and as a senior regional analyst. He also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
Thank you, Ian.
And today, the Secretary of State had her hearings both before the Senate and House committees on the Benghazi incident, which frankly has been a pretty much a trumped-up crisis from the beginning, largely drummed up by Fox News, it would seem, as a way to undermine President Obama's foreign policy credentials during the last elections. It wasn't a surprise that a number of Republican senators and congressmen came out of the gate with the Fox News talking points. How do you think Secretary of State Clinton handled it?
I think she did pretty well. Personally, on some of the issues that came in front of her, I would have come back harder at them. But she is very, very political and very controlled, and doubtless has some notion of a future in politics, and I don't think she wanted to offend them. But, for example, on the whole issue of the lack of funding for the State Department, which goes back 30 years for security, which I had to deal with abroad, she said the Congress, you know, or the administration and the Congress needs to come together, when in fact this problem has been chronically Democratic. It is partisan, goes back a long way, and it gets to the heart of the fact that a lot of Republicans basically believe the State Department is not doing the kind of work they're interested in. It has a more internationalist view than they do, and they believe it might be even more liberal than they are, and also that it doesn't have a tough enough stance on Israel, as Republicans and often more recently become almost unconditionally supportive of Israel. And so I think there are ways of coming back harder, not by saying all that, but just by putting the blame where it belonged, on the Republican caucus on the Hill.
Well, the Fox News talking points have been fairly scandalous in suggesting that her concussion was faked and that she was avoiding these very hearings. So I think as a showdown, I don't think they were very successful, because I'm not sure that they were dealing with reality. And when the Tea Party Senator Johnson tried to blame her and accuse her of this cover-up about Benghazi, let's just go to the clip of Hillary Clinton today before the Senate.
But what was going on and why they were doing what they were doing?
No. We were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But
the American people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator. Now, honestly, I will do my best to answer your questions about this, but the fact is that people were trying in real time to get to the best information. The IC has a process, I understand, going with the other committees to explain how these talking points came out. But, you know, to be clear, it is, from my perspective, less important today, looking backwards, as to why these militants decided they did it than to find them and bring them to justice, and then maybe we'll figure out what was going on.
And that was well said.
That'll probably be the soundbite on the nightly news, I imagine.
One of them, yes, and I hope so. But she handled herself very well. She kept smiling through a lot of things that I personally wouldn't have been able to smile through. I'm a little bit more short-tempered and frank. I think she showed herself as a very, very diplomatic and careful person. And she really went to the heart of some of the issues that were a problem in Benghazi, but particularly some of the dysfunction that occurred in the State Department. And I cite in particular the diplomatic security assistant secretariat with which, frankly, Ian, I've had problems. I think it's one of the most dysfunctional parts of the State Department, and it does need help. And I think, frankly, those people probably did the most to fail the secretary in this instance.
So what did you make then, Wayne White, again, scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries and North African countries, and he was a expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group and was previously deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Offices of Analysis, and served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. The substantive part of the discussion, of course, had to do with what's happening in Libya and in the region in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that that was what anybody much was interested in, at least in terms of those that controlled both the House and the Senate committee, the Republicans, who I don't think were interested in a geopolitical lesson about what's happening in that part of the world. But what was your sense of what she had to say there? Because I just spoke yesterday, I think it was, with a couple of days ago with the former U.S. ambassador to Mali, Vicky Huddleston, who really said that that area has been neglected, that the Sahel is roiling, and this is a serious problem that could have been handled earlier, and it's just going to get worse.
Well, as you know, I served in Niger, right next door to Mali, and so I'm pretty familiar with that area, and came up close to the Mali border and went up into that Saharan terrain several times myself, and the entire Sahel, that is the region that encompasses what most people know as Mauritania, Mali, Niger, and Chad, east to west. It's huge. It's about six or seven times the size of the state of Texas, and it's 90% Sahara, and every one of these countries is appallingly poor and generally bereft of any resources the world cares about. And so getting the Congress, which is already chopping down State Department budgets, sufficiently interested in the security of personnel assigned to these very troubled areas, is extremely difficult. And when the United States State Department has to pick apart its priorities from a budget that's already reduced, that just means that the lowest priorities, the smallest missions, and the least critical countries by the standards of the world, you know, oil and the population size, et cetera, are going to get short shrift. And I saw that firsthand. And so naturally, a place like Mali can fester for quite some time without a lot of resources being dedicated to it. Not only just because of what I said, but also because there are other challenges ahead of it in the pecking order, such as Syria, such as putting Libya back together again, et cetera.
So she did, Secretary Clinton did talk about what just happened at this gas facility in Algeria. And it's pretty clear that the remnants of that long civil war, the defeated Islamists who were literally the entire population of Algeria rejected them, even though there was sympathy for them in the beginning. They did actually win an election, or they were poised to win an election when the military canceled the results. And a long civil war, a 10-year civil war ensued. But these people on the feast on the Islamist side became so crazed and so bloodthirsty that they have little traction left, and their remnants went into that area. And then if you could add to that the enormous flow of arms that came out of Libya, and then the idea that somehow this is al-Qaeda's new front, you have a pretty toxic stew there. And my understanding is that it's the military, it's the Pentagon that's starting to look at it, let alone how the State Department's been shortchanged all along.
We've all looked at this, even as far back as in the years shortly after 9/11, one of the extremist Algerian groups, GSPC for its French acronym, which was the precursor for the al-Qaeda in the Maghreb group, had a nasty cell operating in northern Mali, and it was terribly remote. Malian security forces were pretty incapable of handling the mission, to say the least, in this, you know, desolate northern area. And we did provide some assistance, the CIA primarily, guidance on the ground, and we provided some logistical support in order to get at that cell, and pretty effectively. But I have to admit, just to give you an example of how tractable things can be out there, the Algerian government, which is very well known to be dysfunctional, autocratic, corrupt, just a mess, frankly, which is one reason there was an uprising, and only their grip keeps the Arab Spring from spreading there, refused to cooperate with us, even though Mali, at the time of this incident, back in the early part of our new century, was right on their doorstep and involved a group that had gone over the border from their country. They would not send helicopters. They would not assist. And frankly, the gas facility crisis and all the deaths that have resulted also reflects some of Algeria's own fumbling incompetence. Going in initially and machine gunning a convoy that contained the hostages themselves without the consultation with outside experts who might have known a better way of doing it. And having this facility inadequately protected with a major Algerian base nearby is just classic for this region, where you have to deal not only with a huge challenge and a huge territory and poverty-stricken countries to the south, but even dysfunctional regime. The one organized regime to the north is dysfunctional and haphazard in its approach.
Well, interesting enough, Wayne White, Ambassador Vicky Huddleston felt that Algeria was the best ally that the U.S. had in trying to contain al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb.
It is. In the immediate area, it is the only real ally we have. Every other country is too poor to mount anything effective. But the Algerians have shown themselves repeatedly to be rather lethargic about taking an active and aggressive role in this, unless provoked, as in the case of the gas facility. And they should have seen that coming, because they had undoubtedly, perhaps even as far as a week or two ahead, been asked by the French to provide the overflight, the intelligence, things like that, and still were caught flat-footed in a very area where these groups were operating and very close to the Libyan border. And so even our best ally in this area is fumbling, incompetent, and at the extremity of its reach in the deep Sahara to its south, about 90% of its resources are concentrated way up on the Mediterranean coast. And so the vast south of Algeria, the largest country in Africa, is, even by Algerian standards, lightly patrolled and governed.
So, Wayne White, obviously there's a long history there, because one of the leaders of this Islamic Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, he fought in the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And he's apparently been a major smuggler in that region. So it's hard to know where politics end and criminality begin, but it does seem belatedly becoming a focus. Just to quote the Secretary of State, or the outgoing Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in today's hearings, where the Republicans were trying to beat her up about the Benghazi overblown manufactured crisis, she did talk about the region and said the Arab revolutions have scrambled power dynamics and shattered security forces across the region, and instability in Mali has created an expanding safe haven for terrorists who look to extend their influence and plot further attacks of the kind we saw last week in Algeria. So that would seem to be laying down the gauntlet for her successor, John Kerry.
Yes, and we have to keep in mind again that the Republican caucus in the House and Senate has been an obstacle in dealing with these issues. Let's face it, when we went into Libya to try to contain the damage, to try to get rid of Gaddafi as fast as possible, in a very minimal way, we were just providing refueling for the Europeans for 95% of the action. The Republicans were all over it as a waste of money, as a new war we had gotten into. And now they're the same people who are criticizing for not enough being known, done, etc., about a problem in Libya. In fact, one of the most aggressive questioners was, needless to say, Senator McCain, who advocated going in there, knew the risks of going in there, has been in Benghazi and knows how much of an unmade bed it is politically, but yet doesn't stop for a second before launching into an attack. And the same happened with regard to the issue of the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in Mali. No sooner had we, as you know, noted that we were going to help the French in an extremely limited fashion and a non-combat role, and there were the critics immediately talking about the U.S. starting another war and spending money and getting involved in this place, when in fact there's a real threat there that needs to be addressed, which now they're all asking questions about.
Again, I'm speaking with Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern and North African countries. He was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, and he previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research as Officers of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and the State Department's representatives to NATO Middle East working groups, and as a senior regional analyst. He also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. So is there anything, though, to some of the criticisms about what happened in Benghazi, not the, the propagandistic Fox News stuff that was used in the campaign that was just sort of manufactured, and which many of the Republican Tea Party types and of course, that libertarian zealot, Senator Rand Paul, they all seized on that. But there seems to have been some legitimate criticism, in as much as there was, as you pointed out, a very small footprint in going in there, and that allegedly it was the women in the administration who weighed in on Obama, and the Joint Chiefs did not want to go in, apparently, but it was Hillary Clinton and Samantha Power and Susan Rice and others who convinced Obama that he had to act, and that there was a bias on the part of Hillary Clinton to more or less assume that everything was okay because they wanted to stick to this narrative that this had worked, the small footprint. Is that an explanation for the lack of security?
No, I don't think so. I think you get trapped, or people in the State Department have traditionally become trapped, and it's a trap not of their own making, of being underfunded, and therefore trying not only to keep a footprint small in an insecure place like Libya, as it's trying to take form with militias that are still armed out there, but also to lowball requests regarding security, because you know that if you make the request you think you're going to need, the Republican caucus in the Congress is going to whittle it down, chop it down, reject it. And so you fall, there is a groove, sort of a rut you can fall into in lowballing your own needs in order to try to comply with a problem that we've been dealing with for decades of the Republicans belittling foreign policy, belittling the role of the State Department, and therefore not wanting really to provide any assistance, enough assistance so that you can cover all your bases.
But wasn't there a big influx of money and attention after the embassy bombings in Africa that were the first blows that Osama bin Laden struck against the United States?
Not as much as you'd think. Sure, in East Africa, in where these bombings took place, in Dar es Salaam and in Kenya, that got a lot of attention, but that did not make money available for the entire breadth of the area that needed focus. And, some of the problems that we have out there are just going to be endemic. We are going to be dealing with instability in particularly central North Africa below the Sahara, because these countries are barely viable. France went in there in the last gasp of colonial expansion, even against the wishes of its own war ministry, because they wanted to focus on Germany and Europe, and went in there because it was the last territory that was available adjacent to their colonies along the coast, and went in there conquering it with light resources, governed it lightly, and so the countries were barely viable. The French didn't really make them any more viable by their intervention, and this is just going to go on and on. And also, we have something that feeds into the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb narrative, and that is the Tuareg tribes that fan out across northern Niger and northern Mali are inherently in conflict with the settled peoples to their south, most of whom are the governing bodies of the governing communities of these countries, because they have such large populations compared to desert nomads. And the raiding and the smuggling and what goes on to the north is looked down upon, and the Tuareg are hostile. And so the Tuareg naturally can be recruited into dissident organizations and now even radical organizations. They're already recruiting ground. And so this area is going to remain a problem. And, in fact, we can't even talk about a Malian problem, because if, as the French, and I've been watching this closely, Ian, as the French have been pressing into Mali, I'm just waiting for desperate Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb personnel to squeeze out like out of a toothpaste tube in northern Niger and make that a problem that is even more difficult to address, because Algeria isn't next door. We have an unruly Libya next door to that region.
Well, just in closing, Wayne White, what I'm getting from this conversation is something I'd like to explore with you just in the last few minutes here, that these desperately poor parts of the world, these failed states, that we don't have an interest in them because it's almost not much you can, or if anything, you can do about them.
Right. But, our interest is 90% AID.
Right, but
oriented in these countries,
sure.
Or was.
But then when they become influenced by Al-Qaeda, et cetera, then they become a military front, and then we pour enormous amounts of resources, military resources in, and get sucked into a war which has no inherent strategic value to the United States, and yet the money that we spend on these wars represents, a hundredfold what we could have spent in making them less a failed state in the first place. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. Even though I think these states have a very thin possibility of becoming something a lot better than a failed state, these problems in little-known countries with largely bereft of resources are allowed to fester until they become a military or an intelligence problem. In this area, essentially, we're lucky in a way because France still considers everything from Chad all the way over to Senegal part of its realm of influence. In fact, these countries are loosely tied to France in a sort of British Commonwealth sort of way, so they can call upon her for help. She's intervened repeatedly in Chad, particularly when the Libyans invaded it under Gaddafi. But at least France is there to take, you know, the forefront of the military action in this case, because the African countries that are sending contingents, as was made clear, I think, in the hearings, these troops are not up to the task at all. The Senegalese detachment that was being sent to Mali was held up because the detachment didn't have enough ammunition. That's how bad off they are. And so, yes, a lot of groundwork that could have been done if we had had more funds from the Congress to be more liberal in addressing these more remote areas could have gone a long way to reducing the instability by simply making the central governments of the South a lot stronger and a lot more professional.
Well, Wayne White, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, where he specializes in a number of Middle Eastern and North African countries. He was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group and previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups, and as a senior regional analyst. He also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Israel for an update on the just concluded elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Israel is Avraham Berg, who's the son of a Holocaust survivor and has been active in politics as a leader in the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003, and he's the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Avraham Berg.
Hello there.
So it seems that this surprise of Yair Lapid's party, a new party, Yesh Atid, that sort of came out of nowhere and won 19 seats. First of all, it looks like Yair Lapid has ruled out forming an anti-Netanyahu bloc in spite of what the Labour Party leader said in terms of forming a centre-left bloc. So is that where we stand now?
Well, it looks that from afar, you know much better about Israeli politics than many of those just elected. Yeah, it looks like that. You have to understand, or our audience has to understand, that we do not have a bipartisan system. We have much more of a European system, which is a coalition formation. And this is various factions and various parties eventually aligned together to create a majority within the parliament. So between Netanyahu's natural bloc, which is 50% of the parliament of the Knesset, and the other bloc, which is 50%, there is a tie. The minute Yair Lapid, which is the new surprising phenomenon of this election, says, I'm not in the non-Netanyahu bloc, so there is no opposition. And Netanyahu has the majority to build the next government.
And mathematically, it wouldn't be possible to build a center-left coalition, would it, without the Arab Israeli parties? And they normally are not approached or don't want to be approached, right?
you touch here two different issues. First, there is no impossibility in politics in general, and the Israeli politics in particular. Okay, we are magicians when it comes to impossible formations, constructions, combinations, and different other exercises, okay? So it is possible. The issue of the Israeli Palestinians or the Israeli Arabs is a very sensitive one because, unfortunately, there are very few parties and very few elected individuals who really understand the democracy as a form, as a system which includes all of its citizens, the 20% of the non-Jews minority as well. And therefore, a statement like the one you just said that, yes, we want to have a coalition, but no, we do not want to have the Arab parties within is one of the flaws and one of the shortcomings of the Israeli democracy. I would say that the Israeli Palestinians position or Israeli Palestinian integration within the Knesset is the litmus paper of our democracy. So far, we fail.
So, Avraham Berg, the Yesh Atid, there is a future party, given its hostility towards the ultra-Orthodox and the leader's clear case that he does not want to subsidize them anymore, and he doesn't want the religious students to avoid military service. That would indicate, if he stands by his principle, which I assume he will, that Netanyahu couldn't have a bloc with him and the ultra-Orthodox parties at the same time. They're mutually exclusive, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And actually what you see as a result of this election, or the results of this election, are not necessarily yet a clear new policy as much as the culture, the atmosphere of hate and incitement and even xenophobia and kind of very negative rhetorics coming from various factions of the previous Netanyahu coalition. Will it be the ultra-orthodoxy versus other pluralistic expression of Judaism? Will it be the Minister of Interior, which is coming from another ultra-orthodox party, who actually came down in such a ugly way against the refugees coming from Eritrea and South Sudan, etc., or any the right-wing extreme elements trying to excommunicate civil society, more leftish expressions. It looks like this is over. It looks like the public voted against it yesterday and looking for different, much more, I would say, cultured, containing, more considerable and plural and tolerant political discourse. I hope that the politicians elected got a message.
Again, I'm speaking with Avraham Berg, the son of Holocaust survivors, and he has been active in politics as a leader in the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003, and he's the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. So the right-wing party that was even further to the right than Likud, with its charismatic leader, there was a sense that that was going, the party called Jewish Home, that he was going to win up to 19 seats. They won 11 seats, I imagine. And he, of course, is adamantly pro-settler and anti-peace with the Palestinians. I imagine the Israeli left and a lot of liberal Israelis are breathing a sigh of relief, aren't they?
Well, there is no doubt that there is an improvement in the sense that this government looks like, or this future government looks like, a bit better than the previous one. But when it comes to the peace process, I hope that people at two positions, the individual who will occupy the foreign ministry and the individual who will be the Minister of Defense, will be people who understand that foreign relations and Israel's integration in the region cannot be expressed through muscles, power, and brute exercise of muscles only, but through something else, through conciliation, through conversation, through dialogue. And I do hope that this kind of a new atmosphere, plus a hope, a new administration's commitment at the White House, will help us to move forward, unlike the last couple of years that were very futile, very frustrating, and in a way very dangerous.
So, Avraham Berg, what explains this surprise then of Yesh Atid, that there is a future? coming out of nowhere, this former TV presenter, whose father was also a politician and a TV personality. And clearly something happened there, because the polls were indicating, as I said earlier, they were indicating that the right-wing coalition and the anti-settler party of Jewish Home were going to do very well. So something happened there. A different group of people came out to vote, surely.
First, it's not all of a sudden. You know, in the last 2 years, there is a kind of earthquake, and the earth is not tranquil. In the last 2 years, it was the summer protest of the middle class out of the streets of summers ago, and there was a few other expressions of the public, I would say, resentment of the current indifference and the current attitude of the government. And therefore, it was only a question of time of where the public protest and the public unrest will express itself, not whether will it do it. So the individual who actually was in the middle and became the container of the left-wing frustration, the center-wing frustration, and the right-wing frustration was exactly this Yair Lapid. Now, in the polls, like in America, like in so many other places, there were two shortcomings. The first one was the swing votes were deciphered in such a way that nobody told them that they should behave according to the uncoding of the pollsters. And the undecided, that the last couple of minutes or last couple of hours, simply jumped off the fence they were sitting on and walked into what looks to them as a good containing alternative. The second is that a lot of the polling here was done in the traditional landline polling, while Lapid's campaign and a few other campaigns were online campaigns, Facebook campaigns, cellular phone campaigns that were actually transparent or below the radar screen of the pollsters. I take it that next time these mistakes will not happen.
So I suppose, though, is it true, Avram Berg, that Netanyahu, in many ways, he doesn't seem to be a likable person? I know the President of the United States doesn't like him. And that
I do not like him as well.
So is that a factor, that he is really sort of wearing out his welcome with the Israeli public?
Listen, there is a limitation time or expiration date. How long can a young magician be either young or a magician?
Uh-huh.
Now, an individual who was a brilliant, shining, promising alternative, 96, might all of a sudden become a pathetic, passive, obsolete leader some 20 years later. And Netanyahu simply exhausted his terms, but not doing a thing. It is not that his terms were can be marked or excelled or remembered with beautiful, amazing, promising breakthroughs.
Well, that leads us to the question of what's going to happen with the relationship with Obama. You know, Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic said that Obama basically says that under Netanyahu, Israel is not acting in its own interests and the relationship is dysfunctional. And on top of that, a number of senior Israeli intelligence officials and former military officials have gone public recently in the last weeks of this election in Israel, condemning Netanyahu essentially as a warmonger and as being a reckless leader. So it's pretty amazing the forces arrayed against him. I'm surprised that he got reelected, frankly, because I thought the Israeli people really valued the U.S.-Israeli relationship more than they valued their leaders.
Well, it's a longer discussion that post-election discussion, but Netanyahu was up until yesterday, was the best default around. It looks like from yesterday on, the new alternatives are starting their way towards his bureau. And if he will not move fast, decisively, with a lot of vision, he simply will disappear.
So just in closing then, Avram Berg, what's your sense of how long before we'll have a sense of what kind of government? In other words...
According to is really low, it might take a couple of weeks, but my feeling is it will be faster because you have two main blocks, which is 50 seats out of 120 already sitting together, which is the 31 of Netanyahu and 19 of Yair Lapid, and they have a lot of motivation to serve together. So the principles will be around very soon. I say in a matter of no more than three and a half weeks, we shall have a new government.
But do you think that in this new government, the ultra-Orthodox are going to be marginalized?
Well, if they will have a role, and there is a fair chance they will have a role, it will be secondary or less important to the competitive roles up until now in the previous cabinets.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today,
Avraham. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Avraham Berg, who is in Israel. He's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as a leader of the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003 and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how union membership in this country has dropped to an all-time low, according to new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Schmidt, who's a senior economist with the Center for Economics and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He has co-authored with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein three editions of The State of Working America. And his research is focused primarily on inequality in the U.S. labor markets and the role of labor market institutions in explaining international differences in economic performance, particularly between the United States and Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Schmidt.
Thank you.
And the Bureau of Labor Statistics just announced that the union membership in the United States has reached an all-time low. Is that right, an all-time low?
At least since we've been taking a careful measure of the unionization rate since basically the end of World War II to the present, it is the lowest rate we've been at, yep.
And just give us the figures then.
Well, right now, about 11.3% of the workforce is a union member. That's down from, say, about 20-25% through the 1970s. And if you go back to the peak, it was probably about a third of all workers in the 1950s. So it's a big fall from the 1950s. It's a smaller fall, but still a steep drop from the late 1970s, and it is an ongoing trend.
So it's basically in a year, has it gone down from 6.9% of the public sector? Well, no, this is the private sector. So it's gone down from 6.9 to 6.6%.
That's right. There's a big difference in the U.S. data between what's happening in the public sector and what's happening in the private sector. If you go back for the last 30 years, the unionization rate in the public sector has held pretty solid between 35 and 40% from the end of the 1970s to the present. It goes up and down a little bit, but it's always been in that range. But over that same period, as I was saying, the unionization rate in the private sector has been falling pretty steadily, and that's pulling down the overall numbers. The numbers in the public sector have been pretty solid for three decades. The numbers in the private sector have been falling very steadily for the last three decades and even from before then, and that's pulling down the overall numbers.
But since the recession, the numbers in the public sector, unionized numbers, has gone down hasn't it gone down because largely there's been an assault on the public unions by a lot of Republican governors?
At the national level, if you look at the data, there's definitely been a big drop this past year in the unionization rate in the public sector. It's fallen from about 37% of public sector workers to 35.9%. Now, that is a bigger drop than we normally see. Though numbers there tend to fluctuate a couple of a tenth of a percent or a half a percentage point, so a 1.1 percentage point drop is a big one. It's a little too early to tell exactly what's causing it, but I think leading suspects have to be exactly what you're talking about, that there has been some payoff to the Republican attacks on the unions to the people who have been leading those attacks, obviously at the expense of public sector union workers.
Now, what have been the effects then of these right-to-work measures in various states, the most recent one of which, of course, was Michigan, that was again somewhat like what happened yesterday in Virginia with a stealth attack on redistricting. The Republicans slipped through a bill. They did the same thing up in Michigan, a right-to-work bill, which the governor, even though there was a lot of pressure against it, has signed. So give us a sense of that. Again, we've seen how the attack on public employee unions by the Republicans, and particularly in Wisconsin with Governor Scott Walker, has had an effect on the amount of union workers in the public sector, which has gone down. How much has this right-to-work legislation in various states affected the private sector unionization?
Well, I think it's too early to tell exactly how and what the impact will be of some of the measures you just mentioned in terms of what's happening, say, in Michigan very recently in the data that we currently have. But we can put the current private sector numbers into some perspective if you think about the comparison with the public sector. And the biggest difference between the public sector and the private sector is that there is ferocious employer opposition to unions in the private sector, and the labor law in the private sector works very strongly against workers forming a union or getting a collective bargaining agreement. So it takes makes it much more difficult for private sector workers. And as I was saying before, if you look over the last 30 years, the public sector unionization rate has, until this past year, managed to hold fairly steady. And even the drop this year, it's too soon to know whether that's a long-term trend or whether it's just a one-year change. But the public sector workers have been able to maintain a very high level of unionization relative to the private sector because they're not subject to the kind of ferocious employer opposition, and they operate in a legal context, where it's much easier to form a union. It's very hard in the private sector to form a union, to maintain a union, to get a collective bargaining agreement. And that, I think, is what we're seeing in these numbers. This long-term decline is because the private sector workforce has been essentially deprived of its rights to collective bargaining because of the way employers take advantage of the laws that we have. And you see that in contrast in the public sector, where you don't have a level of employer opposition and where you have a legal structure that's more welcoming, conducive to unionization, at least historically, we have a much higher unionization rate. The big development the last year is, in the last couple of years, is that Republican governors in particular have started to try to take the tactics that the private sector has used against unions in the private sector and put them into the public sector context.
So why is America unique in its hostility to unions? The Europeans, I imagine, and you've done a lot of work, John Schmidt, on the differences between economic performances, particularly between the United States and Europe, in regard to the role of labor and labor markets. First of all, in other European and advanced democracies, the labor parties tend to have closer ties with unions, as opposed to the Democratic Party that used to have closer ties with the unions. And then under Clinton and others, it sort of moved towards Wall Street in search of more money, I take it. And the labor unions don't have the influence that they had. That maybe is one factor. My other understanding is, for example, in Germany, which has the most successful economy in the world and in a very, very effective export economy, they have, I think, 50% of the seats on the board of directors of these big companies belong to union representatives, and that's apparently a law. So there is a lot of, obviously, reasons for why the Europeans have a more labor representation. But it doesn't explain the hostility. And where does that come from?
Well, that's a very big, deep question, and it's hard, I think, to completely understand, you know, what the motivation is. But the one thing that I would say is that the United States historically has had much higher unionization rates than we currently have, and unions played a much more central role in the, you know, in our politics, in our economic system, and in our social system in terms of, you know, supporting a lot of long-term progressive changes in this country. So I think, you know, to say that we're uniquely hostile to unions is, I think, not... there's an element of truth there, but there's also a long-standing historical experience we have of unionization in this country. A comparison I find particularly useful is between the United States and Canada. If you... You know, we have very similar economies. We have... not in terms of size, but in terms of the kinds of activities that we do here. We have a similar standard of living. And if you look at the data, as my colleague Chris Warner has done, for unionization in Canada versus the United States, they track each other very closely in the 1920s, the 1930s, 50s, 60s, and into the 1970s. And then suddenly, Canada maintains a high level of unionization about where the United States was, a little bit ahead of where we were, and the United States starts to plummet. And I think the key difference there is, you know, Canadians, as I said, have a similar kind of economy, similar reliance on foreign trade, even more than we do. They have a similarly well-educated workforce. The big difference was that Canadian labor law is much more conducive to unions forming and getting a first contract. In the United States, we have a legal system that is very hostile to unions, and you can see it in the numbers, this big divergence. Canada has more or less held steady. They've lost a little bit of union membership in the last few years, but compared to the United States, this wide gap has opened up, and I really think it has to do with the legal framework that we have here.
Well, but the legal framework comes out of politics, doesn't it? If you go back to the Taft-Hartley Act, one of the things that it did, which I think really crippled the union movement in this country, was it banned secondary strikes. And in almost every other advanced democracy, when unions go on strike, their brothers and sisters in other unions join them, and therefore they become incredibly effective. So by passing that law, which was passed some time ago, making secondary strikes illegal, they really did undercut the leverage of unions in terms of strikes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you are making an extremely important point, which is that legal framework does come straight out of a political context. And I think it goes back to a point you were making earlier, which is there is a much stronger set of ties between the social democratic parties in Europe and their labor movements. That, of course, has broken down a lot in the last 15 or 20 years with the rise of, say, New Labor in Britain, or with the rise of their kind of counterparts in the French Socialist Party or in the German Social Democratic Party. And, you know, meanwhile, in the United States, I think that the role and the strength and the weight of the union movement in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in the Democratic Party was stronger than it is now, but it was never at the same level that European unions had within their left parties.
But what about the point I was making earlier about Germany having representatives of unions on the boards of directors of major companies? And it seems to have, in part, contributed to Germany's incredibly robust economy and the world's leading export economy. Is there a connection there?
I think that there is a connection, but I think it also illustrates the other point you were making, which is that there is a political context that leads to an institutional setup where unions have representation on the boards. The one thing I would say in terms of Germany, which I do think in terms of standard of living for working people is one of the highest in the world, if not the highest. The one thing that I would say is that since unification in particular, there has been a big push from the center-right and the left-wing party, the Social Democratic Party within Germany has participated in this in terms of restructuring the labor market to make it people euphemistically call more flexible, which means it's easier to get rid of workers, it's easier to put workers on temporary contracts, it's easier to contract out. The unionization coverage rate in Germany has fallen a lot in the last 15 or 20 years, I think hugely to the detriment of the functioning of the economy. The economy is doing well despite that. But there are a lot of pressures, even in some of these much more successful economies, towards doing the kinds of things that we've done in the United States that essentially redistribute income upwards for the benefit of a relatively small share of the population.
Well, just to return to our economy here, John Schmidt, again, senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and he, along with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein, are the co-authors of three editions of The State of Working America, and his research focuses primarily on inequality in the U.S. labor market and the role of labor market institutions in explaining international differences in economic performance, particularly between the United States and Europe. Clearly, the public sector layoffs that have happened since the meltdown on Wall Street in 2008 have been a major drag on our economic recovery. And of course, that's a part of the general Republican thrust towards austerity in the name of deficit reduction. That's the excuse. But there seems to be a broader excuse for why American workers are doing poorly and, in fact, doing worse. And the private sector unionization has dropped from 6.9 to 6.6 in just 1 year. It seems to me that this new hoax, globalization, has become an excuse, a very convenient excuse for American capitalists to downsize their workers. And their excuse being that, well, I'm sorry, we can't pay you more wages. Wages have been flat since the 1970s because there's a new economic environment out there. You know, you're competing with Sri Lanka and Bangladesh now.
Yeah, I'm always amazed by those kinds of arguments because people are basically saying, we're being told by people pushing kind of NAFTA-style agreements and even worse than NAFTA-style agreements, that the only way we can become prosperous or maintain our national prosperity is by engaging in these particular, you know, deals, which I'm reluctant to call trade deals because a lot of them have very little to do with trade and they have a lot more to do with things like investor rights. They have a lot more to do with things like copyright and patent protections, all sorts of things that have very little to do with foreign trade in a direct sense. But the point is, the argument is made that these trade deals are crucial to maintaining our prosperity, and yet we're also told at the same time, in practically the same breath, that now that we're involved in these trade deals and now that we're involved in this globalization process, we can no longer afford to pay people what we used to pay them. So if the point of these things is to make us richer, I don't understand why we all have to earn less and have fewer benefits. You know, it really raises the direct question of, well, you know, why are we bothering to do these things? You know, wouldn't we just be better off if we didn't do it? And, you know, we don't get an answer to that question. We're not told, well, why don't we just sit this one out?
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Schmidt.
Great, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Schmidt, who's a senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He has co-authored with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein three editions of The State of Working America, and his research is focused primarily on inequality in the U.S. labor market and the role of labor market institutions in explaining international differences in economic performance, particularly between the United States and Europe. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And you can also contact us at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now. Down in America, the guy that lived next door in 305.